This is the fourth day of this November 2011 seven-day sesshin. We'll resume reading from our text, The Way of Korean Zen, by Kusan Sunim, 20th century Zen master, or Son. The Korean word for Zen is Son, S-O-N. An ancient master once said, "The bright light of the mind has never darkened. From ages past to the present, it has been the brilliant way. When entering this door, discard intellectual knowledge." That's the ancient master he's quoting. When entering this door, discard intellectual knowledge. We don't need it in practicing Zen. We don't want it getting involved in practice, at least in the Zendo. Yasutani Roshi, I'm told, once held up a ballpoint pen, said that if this pen represents our true mind, then the intellect is no more than the little ball, the little tip of the pen. This prefrontal cortex that we human beings share and that is unique to us as a human species, of course, does marvelous things, but it will not help in the least in terms of coming to terms with life and death. And it causes us so much unnecessary suffering. And then Kusan Sunim continues, "This bright spiritual light, which is able to hear this sound and see this staff, has not darkened even once. Not once has it become a sentient being. Not once has it become a Buddha. For this reason, it is the way that is eternally radiant." In other words, it is beyond changing conditions of whatever lifetimes, whatever forms that we find ourselves in. Therefore, when entering this door, discard intellectual knowledge. After practicing for a while, you may come to think that you know something. Then you start conceptualizing. For example, if you have been meditating on Mu, you may think, "That which says Mu, isn't that it?" Those working on What is this? May think, "That which says What is this? Isn't that it?" This approach is wrong. Therefore, avoid speculative thinking. You must possess truthfulness and sincerity in order to practice correctly. To practice simply because others are doing so is just imitation. You will never achieve anything in that way. You must truly awaken in order to be freed from the suffering of birth and death. Knowledge and conceptualization are not appropriate. He's not saying that knowledge is, there's something wrong with knowledge itself. We know that it has its place, of course, but that the place is not the Zendo. The trouble with this is that usually when we are dwelling in our thoughts or bringing forth what we know or what we think we know, we're not aware of it. We're not aware of it as acquired knowledge. We just think it's the way things are. So, for example, we have some notion about ourself based on past experiences, ways people have reacted to us or spoken to us. So we build up a notion, an image of ourselves as being such and such a way. And it's not that it would have no validity to it, but to work with that, to dwell in this thought of ourself as being such and such, only impedes us in our practice of Zen. We don't need that. Besides, we're not in any way fixed in an absolute sense. We have a certain continuity to our personality or character. We know certain things that are not likely to change, but there are so many things that can change in each one of us that it's just erroneous to cling to any particular idea of ourself. But when we're doing that, when we're thinking about ourself, we don't think of it as something we've picked up, some acquired thing. So the challenge is to notice. That word again, notice. To notice when we have lapsed into thought. So that we can then get our mind off ourselves or others, anything. Or here's another one. Thinking we know how things will unfold during the course of a seven-day sesshin. People who've been to many sesshins will have learned that there are some predictability to it. At least there's been a certain pattern that has repeated itself from one stage of sesshin to the next. But the truth is, we don't know. We don't know what the next day will be. We don't know what the next hour will be. We only know what the pattern is from the past. So to sit and think, I know that all things will really come together on day five, but then I always hit the wall on day six, and so this just gets in the way. Who knows? Who knows what will unfold for this sesshin? This word sincerity that he uses, you must possess truthfulness and sincerity in order to practice correctly. One way to understand sincerity, he mentions about not imitating others, but there is a deeper way to understand it, which is when practicing, when working on one's practice, the breath or the koan, to whatever extent one can, to do so with an undivided mind. Because when the mind is divided, you could say that in a sense, you could say we're not completely sincere. Part of the mind is on the practice. Another part of the mind is jumping around here or there. In this sense, sincerity means with the mind wholly absorbed truly absorbed in this one practice. I think this becomes more obvious when you reach a place of absolute absorption in the practice. Then you can feel as though for the first time in your practice, you're really practicing sincerely when your whole mind is on it. And it may not last that long, but it's a sense of integrity, wholeness. So again, noticing when our attention is split, and then getting back and trying to get more completely into the practice. And then this word truthfulness, again, you must possess truthfulness and sincerity in order to practice correctly. It makes me think of a exchange with the great Joshu, when a monk asked, "What is the first principle of the one wearing the Buddhist robes?" And he said, "Not to deceive himself." There's so many ways we can deceive ourselves. The mind is so endlessly wily, always ready, opportunistic, ready to appropriate for itself, for the ego, whatever progress, whatever gains we've made in our practice. So many kinds of rationalizations. Through long practice, we more and more catch on to these things. We notice the ways that we deceive ourselves. Kusan Sunim continues, "When you investigate the koan and intend to awaken to your great original nature, you must be like a hen hatching eggs. Think about how much effort the hen must exert in order to successfully hatch eggs. From dawn to dusk, she constantly pecks and searches for food. Imagine how hungry she gets while sitting on the eggs all day long." Remember that Kusan Sunim grew up on a farm. His father was a farmer. "If she frequently leaves to eat or drink, only half of them will hatch properly. The rest will rot. While the hen is hatching her eggs, she does not just sit quietly. She moves the eggs around with her feet in order to evenly distribute the heat. Only in this way will the chicks hatch successfully. It is the same for somebody practicing meditation. Whether you are investigating what is this, mu, or the oak tree in the garden, the practice will not mature if you just hold the koan motionless. If you just watch it repeating, 'What is this? What is this?' then you would be like a hen trying to hatch her eggs without moving them. This would be foolish. You cannot awaken in this manner. You must be like the hen who moves her eggs around." But again, this is true as far as it goes, but even if one is not questioning the koan, if one feels that that is just causing more problems than anything else, and you're just concentrating single-mindedly on the practice, one's engagement with the practice must be an active one, not static, not dead. Must be a vitality to it, a vibrant stillness, not a dead stillness, not just staring at the koan, but engaging with it, even if not through questioning. I can't articulate anymore what this means, but I think most people will get the spirit of this. Really, it just comes down to attention. How much of your attention is on the practice? If all of your attention is on it, then it will be vibrant. It will be vital. Otherwise, it'll be less so. You must also be like a cat trying to catch a mouse. Look at the look of a cat that is trying to catch a mouse at the foot of a stone wall. While slinking along at the base of the wall, it keeps its eyes firmly fixed on the hole where the mouse entered. At a place far away from the hole, it then sits silently in hiding. Its eyes continue to stare piercingly at the hole while waiting for the mouse to come out. At such a time, even if a person, a chicken or a dog, goes near the cat, it takes no notice of their passing and continues to watch the mouse hole. If the mouse appears for even an instant, like a flash of lightning, it leaps and grabs it. If even a cat proceeds so mindfully when trying to catch a mouse, how much more so should a person pursue awakening when practicing meditation? Another analogy Roshi Kaplow would sometimes suggest is holding up a meat bone before a dog. I can still remember him saying, the dog's whole world at that moment is the size and the shape of that bone. Animals have this natural capacity for samadhi, of complete absorption, as do children, as did we all as children. But then along the line we misuse our minds in so many ways and have it become cluttered, and we habituate to scattering our attention. Then we have to relearn it. But relearn it we can. It just takes, you know what, practice. Furthermore, you must practice with a feeling of urgency, as though you are trying to extinguish a fire burning on your head. This is another ancient metaphor. In such a situation, would you stop to ponder, is this heat due to fire, or is it really burning or not? Is there anybody present here who would experiment and let the fire burn for a while to see how well it burns? under such circumstances, without thinking, you would immediately brush your hand over your head in order to get rid of the fire. You should cultivate meditation with the same sense of urgency. This can be hard for most people to cultivate this sense of urgency. You can't manufacture it, although it does develop through practice, through deepening practice. One becomes aware of the fragility of life, and that we can't count on how long we're going to live. One of our session participants, Jeanette Prince Cherry, who was sitting here in the center aisle, got a call last night that her husband had died suddenly. Apparent heart attack. To live long would be to live for 100 years. A short life is over in the time it takes to inhale and exhale a single breath. 100 years of life depends upon a single breath, for life stops when respiration ceases. Can you afford to wait for 100 years when you do not know how soon death will come? You may die after having eaten a good breakfast in the morning. You may die in the afternoon after a good lunch. Some die during sleep. You may die in the midst of going here and there. No one can determine the time of death. Therefore, you must awaken before you die. Then he offers a verse in the Dharma Dhatu of the 10 directions. Dharma Dhatu means, it's like our true nature, Buddha nature. In the Dharma Dhatu of the 10 directions, the 10,000 defilements and subtle functions all arise from your own mind. Where will you seek the Buddha's truth? The toad in the snow catches and swallows the tiger. You know, in each one of these verses that we've read from by Kusan Sunim, there is this paradoxical or contradictory element to it. It's Zen style of expressing that which is beyond all sense, that which is beyond all reason, beyond our rational minds, this frontal cortex of the mind. It's a way of pointing to all the rest of that pen, that ballpoint pen. He goes on, look at the sea. Not only when there is wind do waves arise. Even when the sea is calm, waves are rising and falling thousands of times. This paragraph, this very short paragraph, sort of just dropped in. He drops it in there. It's not real obvious how it relates to what's around it. But I would say that what he's talking about here, when he says that even when the sea is calm, waves are rising and falling thousands of times, he's talking about the law of causation, that everything we do, everything we say, every thought we have generates waves. And these waves spread out, and we call this karma. A few lines before this paragraph, he says, the 10,000 defilements and subtle functions all arise from your own mind. So even when the mind is calm in deep meditation, we are not entirely free of causation. His predecessor, Chinu, from the 13th century, we mentioned him earlier in Sesshin, kind of the Bodhidharma of Korean Zen. Chinu once was talking about how even after awakening, there is still so much work to be done. And he expressed it this way: the wind ceases, but the waves still surge. He continues, a defiled person will call this world a sea of suffering. An awakened one will call it a Buddha world. At that time, the 10,000 things will be transformed into the 10,000 subtle functions. For an enlightened person, it is simply all illuminated. For a defiled person, it is simply all defiled. All is arising from your own mind. The Buddha world arises from your own mind. Its transformation into the sea of suffering likewise arises from your own mind. Assembly, reflect on this. I trust that your practice will progress during this winter retreat. The point he's making here is really the basis of meditation practice, is that our experience of reality is determined by the mind. There it is. Our experience of reality, of life, death, and everything else is determined by the mind. If only everyone would practice meditation. We have the power to change our experience of life. It's awe-inspiring, this power that we have, the power of mind. And working, training ourselves to know how to use the mind in the most intelligent way to avoid unnecessary suffering, the ways that we torture ourselves in our mind. We chant every morning in Affirming Faith in Mind, for things are things because of mind, as mind is mind because of things. second lecture. Now, I guess this would be 2 weeks later. This, as we said yesterday, these are talks from a winter retreat, a 90-day retreat. And this is the second. Let's call it Teisho. Since we have entered this meditation retreat, 2 weeks have gone by. Now only 75 days remain. That line never fails to bring a joy. No comment necessary for that. The sufferings of transmigrating within the ocean of birth and death, as well as the happiness of the sublime Dharma Dhatu appearing brilliantly clear before your eyes, do not come from outside. They are also not given to us by anyone else. You do not have to endure sufferings because someone else gave them to you. Neither does somebody else grant you happiness. They are created and experienced by yourself alone. You have to endure sufferings because you created them yourself. Likewise, you experience happiness because you have created it yourself. You don't have to believe in the law of causation, of karma, in order to practice, but it does enrich your practice. If you can allow, is how this great law is true. Because it places in our hands the ability to change. So it's empowering. You can't prove it, can't prove the law of causation, but to believe it is empowering. Because now we know that we have this power to change. Change ourselves, change our experience. During the 24 hours of the day, in all of the four positions, when you are coming, the koan should be coming. And when you are going, the koan should also be going. You should investigate earnestly, carefully, and in detail. I always carefully observe meditators when they are walking here and there. How many hold the koan firmly in the mind? Usually when they are coming and going or eating, they completely forget about the koan and just act blindly according to circumstances. With such practice, it is hard to say when such people will ever awaken. You must pay a great deal of attention to this point. Yeah, this point cannot be overemphasized. To make every effort to keep the awareness of the practice continuous, and not just to drop it when we cross the threshold of the Zendo, when leaving, but to keep it going. It has such an impact on one's practice to keep it going outside the Zendo. It's hard, but if ever we stand a chance of doing it, it's during Sesshin. In these conditions, it can be done. one of the problems with doing it, one of what makes it so difficult, is that we can get frustrated when we notice that we've lost the practice. When we're walking down the hall, or we're eating, or we're working, or anything else, when we notice that we've lost it, maybe we realize that it's not been on our mind for 5 minutes even, or an hour even, our mind has just been all over the place. The problem really comes when we get disgusted with ourselves for having lost it. There's no need for the disgust. There's no need for the exasperation. Just return your attention to the practice right there, no matter how long it's been out of your mind. When he said when he says you should investigate earnestly, carefully, and in detail, this is a great advice in working with a practice, not just a koan either, but breath practice, to look closely, look directly into the practice, watch it, draw closer to it. Get in close to it. Look at it with that piercing attention that the cat has watching the mouse hole. Watch the mind. The mind means the practice in this case. If you're questioning a koan, do it meticulously. Meticulously, not half-heartedly, not carelessly, but with full attention. He goes on, you should take great awakening as your aim and model, you should take great awakening as your aim and model, and never let the mind be at ease. If you act without caring to raise the koan, mind and body will surely be at ease. But this is just like water flowing away. Indeed, the lives of sentient beings flow away like this. Let me comment on this. The whole point of the koan is to focus our innate questioning. To be human means at some level of the mind, even though we may seldom be aware of it, at some level there is wondering. Wondering about what we're doing here, where we came from, where we're going, what death is, where we will go after death. This wondering, I suspect for most people, is unconscious. They're not much aware of it. For too many people, it gnaws at them, keeping them awake at night and causing problems in relationships and work. This underlying angst of not knowing. Questioning. But for most people, it remains diffuse. It has no focus to it. It comes and goes, maybe times of loss, and sick, or someone close to you dies, or you even losing a job. This questioning can come up. But it's basically ineffective because, as long as it's diffuse. The koan takes that and and draws it together. It concentrates that questioning, and that gives it the power to really open up the mind. But it is also a state of discomfort to be in this state of this doubt, doubt meaning questioning. So for most of us, when life is going well enough, then it's going well enough, and who needs doubt? Who wants it? Who wants to be turning the mind to what it cannot solve and it's with its ordinary functions? But it's a conditioned state, this whatever state of contentment we may be lucky enough to find. It's based on changing causes and conditions, and it will surely, at some point, it will run out. This is what he means, right? This is just like water flowing away. Indeed, the lives of sentient beings flow away like this. Now, having taken up the practice of 10,000 actions, you should endure what is difficult to endure and do what is difficult to do. This is known as austerity for the very reason that it involves undergoing what is difficult. The Buddhas and the patriarchs did not realize Buddhahood easily. They realized it through great effort and much hardship. They exerted themselves with such great effort because the sufferings of birth and death are so terrifying. Therefore, even though you want to sleep more, you should sleep less. Even though you want to eat more, you should eat less. Even though you want to talk a lot, you should try to talk less. Even though you want to see many things, you should see less. Your body will definitely feel restrained by acting in such a way. This is indeed a practice of austerity. However, none of the Buddhas and the patriarchs would have awakened had they not trained themselves in this manner. Well, he's raising some values, values of discipline that I think to a large extent have gone out of favor in modern times. It's we've been captivated very much by this idea that we should be able to do whatever we want whenever we want to do it. And why not? Isn't that our right? And that is a way to sort of coast through life and derive a certain amount of pleasure and comfort, but it's not a recipe for going beyond ourselves, going beyond the self, overturning this ordinary consciousness, seeing what is beyond it. Seeing through suffering. I'm guessing that everyone here knows intuitively the truth of what Kusan Sunim is saying here. Otherwise, why would you have come to Sesshin? You know what Sesshin is like. Even though you want to sleep more, you should sleep less. Even though you want to eat more, you should eat less. Even though you want to talk a lot, you should try to talk less. Even though you want to see many things, you should see less. He's presenting a way that traditionally has been the way of monks. It's a way of discipline, of deliberately limiting one's trafficking in the world of phenomena, the world of the senses and all of its pleasures, deliberately limiting those so that we can acquire a new perspective and see beyond them, see something that is eternal, not subject to the changes of these things. This is our chance. Here we are. In our daily lives, most of us don't have the luxury, and it is kind of a luxury, to lead this kind of a simple daily structure. Now we do. Can we make the most of it in the remaining 3.5 days of the Sesshin? Stop now and recite the four vows.